shouts of space.
Hello, Rational Face podcast listeners. Before we get into today's episode, I'd like to ask a favor. Our podcast is released through our website as well as iTunes. If you already use iTunes, good for you. Now for the favor. We'd like you, yes you, to go to iTunes and rate the Rational Face podcast and write a gloriously positive review. If you're going to write something negative, don't do us the favor. This will help us reach a wider audience and expand the Mormon dialogue that you are interested in, as evidenced by listening to this podcast, to even more people. Today's show is the first of many stories of faith transitions. I have the opportunity to interview all of the Rational Face permabloggers and give them a chance to share their story. So far, I have found that each faith transition is as unique as the person telling the story. To start off the three interviews in today's episode, I start with Jonathan Cannon. He has blogged for Rational Face since October of 2013. He often writes about theology and transhumanism, as well as other topics. So let's jump right in with Jonathan.
So I live in Middle Georgia, in a small town with my wife and kids. Got two boys and a third boy on the way. And I teach chemistry at a small college that, if I understand correctly, was one of the first or the first junior college in the United States, but now it's changing into something else, a small four-year college. And let's see, I'm a lifelong Mormon. My family is largely a Utah and Southern Idaho family historically. My parents and lots of aunts and uncles and cousins still live in the Mountain West. And I've lived a fairly typical LDS life growing up, going to high school in Utah and college at BYU, and then moving away for graduate school, doing the things you would expect as typical as far as life events and being LDS. So that's kind of a brief summary.
Sounds like you've got the list checked off pretty good. So first of all, how did you like moving to Georgia after living in the desert in Utah for a while?
So I hadn't lived in the desert for, 7 years of graduate school, 3 years of a postdoc, and then 2 years in teaching in North Carolina before coming here. So I'd been in the Midwest and the South for, 12 years before coming to Georgia.
Where were you in the Midwest?
Madison, Wisconsin and Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay. I'm in the north side of Columbus right now. I spent time in Iowa City for graduate school.
Okay.
So. Well, that's fun. And congratulations on your to-be-born child.
Yes, thanks.
That's exciting.
It is.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your faith transition? There's a lot of most people involved in the online Mormon community seem to have changed in their faith in some degree. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that story?
All right. So I'm never sure how to tell this story because for me, it's either been and is a gradual ongoing process or it hasn't really happened. And I guess it depends on who I compare myself to know. But I haven't had a sudden faith transition like many people I hear about or read about in the Bloggernacle or in podcasts. So for me, I identify a few things. The first one really came up with evolution back in high school. And that's when I started hearing that I was a heretic for believing evolution. But at home, I had parents who presented me with ideas from faithful LDS biologists that said you can believe in evolution just fine and be LDS. And so I still struggled with it, trying to reconcile creation accounts and evolution for, and trying to deal with a culture that sometimes said, oh, you're a heretic or don't really believe in Mormonism if you believe in evolution. And so I spent 15 years at least trying to come to a place where I was comfortable with that. But that I guess it opened my eyes to the variety of belief within Mormonism and started it. But then things have continued to come along just here and there. Some of the big ones in my life are how we teach young people and single people about sexuality. And I've had to deal with the idea that, oh, all sexuality is evil, and then you get married and it's supposed to be good. And that set of teachings did not equip me well to deal with human sexuality. So I had to come to terms with that. And environmentalism was something I cared about when I was, well, I still care about, but cared about when I was younger. And read Hugh Nibley's thoughts on environmentalism and various social things, and that influenced me there. So I don't know. It's been piecemeal, and I've changed what I believe and how I live, but it's never been one big crisis.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of sneaking up on you, if at all. So was Hugh Nibley your first dive into anything that wasn't printed by the church, basically, into studying Mormonism?
Probably. It's been long enough ago that I don't remember, but he was one of the early big influences, late high school and early college.
Okay, so you talked about, I kind of had a similar early incidents with cognitive dissonance in studying geology, and that verse in 2 Nephi about no death before the fall, and here I'm in a class looking at fossils that are clearly older than 6,000 years old, and, you know, that didn't jive really well for me. So what were some of the things there, and then later on with the environmentalism and Hugh Nibley, what are some of the books or resources that you found most beneficial to opening up and broadening the spectrum of Mormon belief for you?
So I thought about this question a little, and it's a little hard for me to answer because, again, my reading was piecemeal and it built up gradually. But some of the things that I think have shaped my views over the years are just the books that some of them had to do directly with the issues of cognitive dissonance, and some of them were just things that have made me fall in love with Mormonism over the years. So, but if I have to pick a couple, I think the one I mentioned, Brother Brigham Challenges the Saints by Hugh Nibley and Approaching Zion by Hugh Nibley, were two that have shaped my view of Mormonism and dealt directly with some issues of science and faith and culture and faith. There's one I came across later called Can Science Be Faith Promoting by Sterling Talmadge. He was the son of James Talmadge, and this book was published, well, much posthumously published in 2001, and it basically he wrote a Sunday school manual about science and religion, but it never got accepted or used. But he wrote one, and that was in 2001, published as a book along with a bunch of letters, some correspondence between him and John Widsoe and Joseph Fielding Smith and some others discussing evolution and religion.
So as you've studied church history, have you wished to live back in the early 1900s when those guys were, it seems like Mormonism was a little bit different and maybe a little bit less dogmatic in that time period.
Sure. I mean, that's, So that relates. I was in my patriarchal blessing counseled to study the words and the lives of the prophets, ancient and modern. That's not the exact wording, but that's essentially the counsel. And so at some point I started taking that seriously, probably approximately when I went on my mission. And I started reading things like Teachings of the Prophet Joseph Smith and Discourses of Brigham Young and then a similar collection, John Taylor, and just started working my way through and also reading biographies of presidents of the church, some modern and some older. And yeah, I mean, Brigham Young said crazy things, but he said gloriously provocative things as well that just, well, call us all to repentance in the sense of living so much better and more responsibly and fuller. And so I fell in love with that stuff. But no, I don't really want to go back. I want to go forward because we hardly knew anything about evolution then and hardly knew anything about chemistry then. And
yeah,
and I'm kind of in love with those things too. So
yeah. Yeah, well, it would have been an exciting time to do chemistry at Princeton with Iring and all those other greats.
Yeah, but we get to build on what they did now. And so
that's right. Well, in reading all the, you know, learning about the prophets and reading Hugh Nibley, then I imagine it opened up and you've read a lot more than that. You've read, from what I can tell, a lot of the classic Mormon history books. So has it accelerated the change in how you view God or how you view the church, or has that still been pretty steady? Did you been reading?
Reading tends to come after reading hasn't generally instigated the changes. It's more come after to try to understand, and it's shaped the changes. But I think more recent changes have come with regards to social issues relevant to LDS life, like how the LGBT community fits in Mormonism and women's issues in Mormonism, and because those have become more personal to me. So I'm going through a second phase that has less to do with the intellectual side of Mormonism and more to do with the social side of Mormon life. And so that one's I'm in the midst of and is a different kind of struggle.
Yeah, it is indeed. I think a lot of people are there right now, including myself. As we kind of wrap up, what books or media or information do you recommend to someone that's in the middle of a faith transition or is just interested in getting into Mormon studies? What would be some of your favorites and recommended reads?
From the science end, I enjoyed the ones, and culture end, I enjoyed the ones that I've mentioned. I also really liked one that was called Expressions of Faith, Testimonies of Latter-day Saint Scholars, and it was compiled, edited by Susan Easton Black, published by Deseret Book about 20 years ago, and I really related to certain of the testimonies in there and the stories in there. I think a lot of my interests have not been directly tied with dealing with specific issues. I really like Terry Warner's book, Bonds That Make Us Free, and that has shaped how I view relationships with people, and I think relationships with the church as well. But I don't know, I recommend finding someone whose path you appreciate and relate to, and that ends up in a place you think you want to be, and see what you can learn about it. So for me, that's been following some of these scientists and scholars, and I imagine for others it would be following a different path. But I just advocate patience and persistence, because I don't know of one good source to answer all the questions.
Yeah, I think you're right there. It Man, after a while, it starts to feel like you have to read everything and you'll never get everything read, and it's overwhelming. But I think you've got good advice on patience and finding a mentor of some sort. It gives me a little bit of hope anyway to see other people that have made it through and are more stable or more comfortable in their faith.
I want to be supportive of people in their faith transitions. I definitely am on the side of hoping people stay and hoping people make it better. And I believe there's a lot of richness in Mormonism, but I live with people that have been hurt or who have lost belief in God, and I see their reasons. So I just want to be supportive and build the church I love, but also just build up the people I love.
Thank you, Jonathan. This has been a fun little conversation. Thanks for talking and take care.
Yeah, you too, Brian.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
My next interview is with Lori Berkman. She has been blogging at Rational Faith since February of this year. The issues that are closest to her heart are women's issues such as female ordination in the LDS Church and the inclusion of the LGBT community within Mormonism.
And I graduated from BYU. I was a technical writer for 3 or 4 years, and now I'm on hiatus from that to take care of the youngins. So that's what we're doing. And my husband, we've been married for 9 years.
Sweet. So technical writer sounds like a super exciting.
You know, people, if I say I'm a writer, if I don't say the technical part, then everyone wants to know, oh, what have you written? You know, and then I show them this, it's like a foot and a half tall of all these technical books. And they're like, oh, I want to read that. I'm like, no, you don't. Like, it was for people to pass high level IT certifications. It was a program that, you know, for Linux or server, I mean, there's a lot. So that's what I used to do.
So what was your degree then that led you?
In English,
there?
With my track was in technical writing, grammar, and editing.
So not the romantic.
No, I can do that. Just doesn't pay as well. So, plus my brain just works really well that way. I love to diagram out a sentence. That's just a fun Saturday night. So.
Cool. All right. Well, Lori, like a lot of us in the Rational Faith and the wider online Mormonism, we've generally had some sort of awakening or a faith transition where you started to look at things different. Why don't you take a couple minutes and describe how you got to where you are now, or at least maybe not to where you are now, but what was there a specific trigger? What was it? What sort of information was it? That kind of stuff.
For me, there absolutely was. In all honesty, 3 years ago, I had a friend 2 or 3 years ago asked me if I was a feminist, and I was like, blah, feminist, pew. Like, that doesn't make any sense. And well, I just had that negative, you know, that negative connotation that comes with it. And 2 years ago, I never would have thought that, not never, but where I am now was not on the radar. So, very quickly, my younger sister, very much out of the blue for our family, she ended up leaving the church, which she was not the person who anyone ever would have thought that would have happened. And she left for intellectual reasons, most of them connected to the historicity and the restoration narrative. And so that was a shock to me because we've always been super, super close, like super close. And I was always the rascally one, and she was always the, like, hyper-Mormon one. And she was the one pulling me back in, you know, as a teenager or as a disgruntled kid at BYU. So that was a surprise. It wasn't anything that she told me. That wasn't it. It wasn't, you know, her new information and stuff that was that changed my mind or got me thinking in any way, shape, or form. But so she leaves the church, and in the next year and a half, she becomes happier than she's ever been. She has a history of deep depression. I mean, we're talking like the 6-year-old that's just crying all the time. Her whole life, she's been depressed and had anxiety problems, and it was just so palpable. And my impression was I was pretty much the only truly happy thing in her life, or like the solid thing in her life for a long time. And that's why we got along so well, is I was like her happy rock in her gloomy, sad island. And so she leaves the church, and all of a sudden she's off all of her depression meds and her anxiety meds, and has self-confidence and gets a new job. And she goes from making a reasonable amount of money to a hefty fat pile of money, and is the breadwinner for her family. And the change in her was so remarkable and so profoundly counter to anything that the church had ever taught me would happen for somebody leaving the church.
Yeah, I haven't heard that lesson about walking away and being
Right?
blessed.
And being blessed beyond measure and finding yourself. And she's happy. She was a person I always knew that she was and wanted desperately for her to see in herself. And I never thought that Mormonism, before we both thought that Mormonism was her source of happiness, and me, obviously. And so, yeah, that was very surprising to me. And that for me, just the proof that you can leave and things, your kids don't automatically get cancer and your husband doesn't lose his job and you both have affairs, That's what I'd always been told would happen. And though I'm a very rational person, apparently that I had too much to lose to ever put anything at risk. I would never read anything. I wouldn't ever do anything that might jeopardize that simply because I know I'm innately rascally and might be prone to being beguiled, I guess. So I kept myself far away from anything that might do that.
Okay, so now you've seen your sister kind of disprove
Yes, thoroughly.
that cautionary tale. And
So
so
that's
then so then you're wondering what's going on. Where did you go?
So
What
she
did you
had been
look
out.
into?
She'd been out for about a year or just over. And again, it's nothing that she said. It wasn't her explaining her reasons. That had just so little to do with it. For me, I mean, I served a mission and I went to BYU and married in the temple and all those things. That wasn't natural to me, though. I'm not one of those who grew up really Molly and Mormonism was great for me. Mormonism was almost always something I was chasing after and desperately trying to make my own, but it wasn't an innate fit. But that wasn't for lack of trying, but I didn't feel the same way at church as everyone else did. It was very apparent. And so and even from a young age, but I always thought that that was because I was unworthy. I never remotely considered it's because the church might not be what it purports itself to be, or it was always because I was unworthy. And that's why this isn't working for me as well as everyone else. And so I was on a 30-year-long quest to prove I was worthy enough so I could finally get my answers and finally find my niche. But I did it all. I mean, I served in every capacity and lived by all the rules, and I very much made Mormonism my own. But for me, my anchor was in studying it because I prayed about the Book of Mormon. I prayed ardently about so many things, and my spiritual confirmations were more than lacking. But so instead, to compensate for that, I'm very scholastic. I'm very intellectual. I love that. So I just built up like my own little knowledge cathedral, and that was my home. I could explain anything. I could cross-reference anything. I knew that Mormonism was true because I could prove it. And it wasn't my fault that it was so hard to spiritually have those confirmations and stuff. So, I mean, I felt close with God. That spirituality was not a problem, but backing up the Book of Mormon and other things, that was the challenge. So anyway, I have a 6-year-old now, and at the time she was 4.5. So this is last summer, last March or so. I have all of these red flags. When you study that much, there are loopholes. There are things that are completely contradictory to one another that you come across, and you just got to shelf that stuff. I mean, there's no way to make sense of it. And so you just keep shelfing, and that's a very common Mormon, you know, tactic. I'm not unique in that. But my shelf had become like the Library of Alexandria. It was big at that point, the older I grew. And my daughter came home from church, and she had the little flip book. She was kind of delayed in learning to talk. So when she was four and a half was really our first time that we branched out from God loves you and we all live in heaven when we die. And I started trying to teach her actual Mormon type things. And she came home from church with a little flip book, the type that you can fill in and draw in at home. And it was the I Will Go and Do story. And she loved the song and was singing the song. And then she handed me the flip book and wanted me to tell her the story and explain it to her. And there's literally like a picture of Laban all unconscious and Nephi there ready to go to town on him with, you know, with the upheld sword. And I'm like, okay, this is it. I'm going to teach this to her. And the second I started, I felt horrible. I felt like a very deep spiritual impression that I should not like this. I got halfway through the story and I just stopped and I looked at her and I'm like, you know what, Addie? Nephi made a really bad choice. God would have come up with a better plan than this. And I sent her on her way, and it was weird. I'm like, why couldn't I just tell her that I will go and do story? You know, I mean, that's kind of a big one. And I just felt really weird. And I almost, it's like I floated upstairs or something and was just in my room staring at the wall. Like, what am I going to do? Like, why doesn't this feel right for me when I'm surrounded by a world of everyone, you know, it's the best thing in their life. And it's their source of closeness to God and all of that. And I looked up and Rough Stone Rolling was right there on my bookshelf. And we bought it contemporarily when it came out, but never read it. I'd had it on my bookshelf for 4 or 5 years or something. And I just felt, I knew, like I looked at it and our eyes met if books had eyes. And I knew I needed to read that book that day. And I read it pretty quickly in probably 10 days, 2 weeks. I mean, it's a hefty book, so that's...
Holy crap. I've had that for like a year, and I'm just finishing it.
Yeah, right?
That's impressive.
I very much... that was a spiritual experience for me, was that. I felt very spiritually inclined that I needed to read that, and then the second I started reading it and realized... I mean, because you don't have to read it for too long to realize, this... was not part of my CES education, you know, just the treasure digging and stuff like that. So the second I realized that there was stuff there that in my 30 years of heavy reading, I hadn't heard about before, that was huge to me. And that's why I read, you know, so quickly. And it changed me forever. I mean, that changed me forever. I immediately ended that and I picked up The 19th Wife by Eliza Ann Young, who was one of Brigham Young's polygamous wives. And I can tell that she's jaded and she's biased, but it's a first person account, which is unheard of. We have so few of those.
Right.
And it was a beautiful way to follow Rough Stone Rolling, because Rough Stone Rolling ends obviously with Joseph's death. And so then that picks up, she starts with Joseph's death and goes through, you know, the Brigham Young and her association with it. So I could tell where she was just grinding her axe. She grinds some axes in there. But that completely, the account of her parents and her story in the Restoration and Mormonism was important to me. And then Mormon Enigma and Insider's View and Blood of the Prophets. And you know, I think I read like 10 biographies in a row. And they all started with the ones like Mormon Enigmas written by women who are members of the church, and obviously Richard Bushman and Russ Stone. I was going to trusted sources as could be. But that it was almost paralyzing to me to see all of the things that were purposefully and systematically withheld from my church education, because I had trusted the church implicitly. That I was an informed member and choosing to serve a mission, there's a lot of things you sacrifice to get married in the temple and stuff. I was doing all of those under the impression that I was making an informed decision. And realizing that that had not been the case was devastating. Like there really honestly aren't even words for how bad that sucked.
So were you, I mean, devastating is hard to describe. Did you lose sleep? Were you able to function normally, or how did that manifest itself?
I'm very much an immersive type of person. Like I got real into Tolkien as a 15 to 21 year old, and I'm very much the type that when I find my new thing, that is my thing, and I'm good with that. I naturally always don't fall asleep until about 3 or 4 a.m. anyway. It's an irregular biorhythm. It's just how God made me, which makes for great late night reading. So that was part of it. Yeah, I absolutely, my husband, gosh, I spent most of my days, if my kids were, once my kids were back in school and stuff, reading online. And again, I mean, there was a long time before I ever went to MormonThink or anything that might, be possibly anti-Mormon literature and stuff, but yeah, I mean, it was the journals and discourses. It was just the things that our own manuals were created from. I was trying to back source as and match and cite as well as possible. Yeah, it was devastating, but more than anything, it was so profoundly interesting. There was so much to learn. I had some really, really bad nights, where the tears came and I felt the oppressive weight. One in particular, which was kind of the culmination of all things in this story, was on July 3rd of last year. I was reading the scriptures along with this, with all of my other reading, making sure I was having a balanced diet of,
Filling your spiritual cup
yeah.
along
But the thing is, it was detrimental. Reading the scriptures along, it was not helping the way it was supposed to help, because then
Thank
all
you.
those anachronisms and all of those, I mean, I had been reading Joseph Smith's contemporary writing, his letters, the way that he spoke, and then I would read the Book of Mormon and be like, oh my gosh, this is like the same rambling sentence structure with extra words included. And like, there were so many things that instead of being a spiritual experience from reading the scriptures, it was almost even more so like, oh my gosh, I don't think this is what it says that it is, and I was reading the Doctrine and Covenants, and I'd gotten to 132, which is the polygamy is addressed there, and it's Joseph speaking, or God speaking directly to Emma and saying he'd destroy her, and it lays out the rules of polygamy. And first off, the church itself didn't follow those rules as laid out by God in that chapter. But
Right.
realizing for the first time in my life what that was about, who was speaking here, whether it's God or whether it's Joseph Smith writing it, either way, there's some nasty, dark stuff there, in my opinion. And for me, if polygamy was God made and God ordained, God would have shown up to both of them. There's virtually no God that I could ever get on board with that would send an angel, talk to Joseph about it solely, and threaten him with whatever the fiery, what, sword and stuff, but never tell Emma about it. And then Joseph can go on for years to be married to her best friends behind her back and women that she was boarding and taking care of in their home and all of that. And and this is what God wanted, I mean, that's, I just blurg. No, I veto that conception of God, I suppose. So if polygamy was ever of God, God would have shown up to both of them. He would have explained it to both of them, and all of the deception and just grossness wouldn't have ever happened. So anyway, I was reading that and I just felt the weight. I felt like that was the first time that it felt like a physical, palpable anxiety attack burden on me while reading this chapter. And I got down and prayed for the first time in my life, prayed with a very open heart. Because before I prayed, like, God, you have to tell me, is the Book of Mormon true? And fully anticipating being told it was true. And that was the only answer I would accept, because it had to be true, because that was my life, that was my
Right.
religion.
Yep.
And that was the promise. they promise you if you ask in good faith and good intent that that will be the answer. So that was the only answer that was ever on the table. And I never got any answer. It was like crickets when I had asked before. But this time I asked, God, are you here? Are you in this? Is this you in this story? I mean, it's written in first person. This is God talking in 132.
Yep. Yeah, it is.
Is this you? You know? And I got my answer of no, absolutely not. And it was just like this communication back and forth. Like, you know me, Lori, is that, do you think that's me? Like, God was offended I was even asking. And I was like, no, yeah, I know that's not you. And so then the next question was like, is this a man-made church? And I just knew it was. I knew it. And I hadn't really put that on the table until then, but I knew it then. And then it was this, you know, but hey, it's still the greatest church out there. Even if it's not exactly, you know, nuts and bolts, fine-tunedly, exactly what it purports itself to be, it's still the best thing out there, right? And so then I asked him, like, should I raise my family in this church? And I knew that that wasn't what would be best for us. So that night, I had my clear answers and my clear communication, and I finally felt peace. Like, I found it. And it's what I've been chasing after my whole life. And the part that sucks is it's not, it wasn't the answer that would make anyone happy, and it was not the easier one. It's so much easier to stay. Oh my gosh. It is so much easier to stay. But that's where I was. And then the next day is the 4th of July, and I realized that I was baptized on July 3rd and confirmed a member of the church, like the dates matched. And I also got my driver's license on July 3rd, and I also received my mission call on July 3rd. And all of those things kind of happened then because my birthday is June 19th, and it's like that two-week lag of things that were supposed to happen on your birthday. And then they happen right before the 4th because everyone goes out of town. So those other things were kind of coincidental but made sense. But this one, there's no reason that I chose, you know, July 3rd to pray. It wasn't on my radar as a date. It just happened that night. And the next day I woke up, I'm like, oh, my gosh, you know, that was the same day I was baptized, however, you know, 20 years ago or whatever it was, 22, I suppose. But then I was stuck with it. Like, what do you do? I went happily married to a very Mormon man.
Mm-hmm.
When I came to him with my problems, I was scared to death because that's such the discussion, right?
The fun conversation.
And I told him, you know, I will support you and whatever your choice is. If you want to keep going to church, absolutely. Hooray for that. But this is where I am. These are the answers I've had. This is my spiritual reality, and I'm just being honest and open with you. And we had just the most amazing conversation, and we weren't on the same page that day, but within 2 months, we had come to the same conclusions and wanted the same things for our family. Without a fight, without a rift, without contention or name calling or anything. It was a really beautiful thing that happened between us. I forever will be more grateful for that than anything else, because that could have ruined our marriage. And instead it was a very organic and beautiful process. I haven't been to church for about 10 months. I stopped going in September of last year.
Do you still have any positive relationships with other members that you knew prior to this?
Many.
Yeah.
There are many. My babysitting pool has significantly shrunk since last year.
Mm-hmm.
No, I tried going. And, I mean, this is Rational Faith, so everyone knows Michael and Paul Barker. They go to church. They rock that. You know, I wanted to be that. It didn't have to be true to still be something great. But once I knew the dichotomy between – I mean, last year was church history year at church, like in their manuals and stuff. So I was sitting in class, and virtually things were being taught in class that were, I mean – just so inaccurate. It was so inaccurate. And I know this because I've read the source material, you know, like that was very hard. Church became anxiety ridden for me. It was very, very, very hard. And so there was that. And it was, I don't know. I had falling out with my bishop that, you know, read my blog post. It's in that, but that's a whole different story. It became almost unbearable. Church did, for multiple reasons. And I just realized that, that one, it wouldn't be good for my family. Two, it, the wards honestly don't want ward members like me. The crusaders to make it better, or the better. I mean, it, obviously that's my view of better. I get that. But, you know, equality for men and women, or accountability for the church's past, that is not something they want brought up. That is not something they want addressed. And you know, it's just, you're, anyway, it didn't work. I tried to make it work for a couple of months, and it ended with a court of love invitation. So it was bad. So anyway, all that's a different story. That's how it ended, though, was I did try to make it work. And I just realized that Mormonism has very little interest in accountability for its past, accuracy in its teachings, or any volition to change and move into something better in the future. That was my experience. So they just wanted to be faith promoting and to keep up the status quo. And that was something I was not able to do at that point in time with the knowledge that I had. So.
Okay. Yeah, that's, it's hard to sit in Sunday school and hear. Yeah. We don't need to go through it again, but
the,
yeah,
Thomas Mark lesson, the one on apostasy, the milk drippings and all of that. I purposely did not go to the church for 6 weeks straight to avoid being there at that lesson, because I knew I would have an unholy meltdown. I'd read it in before, and then the week I show back up at church after a 6 week hiatus to avoid it, that was the lesson that was taught, because their scheduling was off. And I sat down, and on the chalkboard it says a pint of milk and a misspelled name, and, you know, three other completely made up reasons why people leave the church. And I just like froze, and I knew that God sent me there that day, you know, type of thing. But, ooh, that's rough. Like, I literally would look at my purse and be like, I can puke in that. Yeah. If I need to puke, I'll just puke in my purse. Cause it was that, it was that real for me, you know? So that was really hard. And for that reason, I very much go out of my way to not ruin anybody else's Mormonism for them. It was so much happier before I knew any of that. And so, especially for people that I know that it would ruin their relationship with their husband, or with their wife or their family. I, with people ask me why I left, my answer is, you know, had I known then what I knew now, I wouldn't have moved forward in Mormonism and made the choices that I made when I was 20, when I was 25, and that's as accurate as I can be without, you know, shoveling around the poo or bursting somebody's bubble or being truth bomby or discrediting their faith that they love. I don't want to do that, because that was so painful for me. But if people come to me and ask me direct questions, that will be a conversation to be had. So, but I very much go out of my way to not now anyway, I don't want to ruin that, because it sucked when it was ruined for me. But it turned out off. Like, the outcome has been best case scenario. But at the time.
Yeah. Especially with your husband not having that seem to go well. I mean, within 2 months, that seems like a good thing to.
Yeah. We both had different outcomes. For me, I became so active in the Mormon fringe and rational faiths, and I had a whole new faith community. And for the first time in my life, I was surrounded by Mormons who were just like me. And that literally hadn't ever felt that way before. And unfortunately, it's now with the fringe and the apostates that I finally relate to. But, I mean, that changed a lot. But for him, he just lost his religion. It was much more a case of mourning for him and loss of identity. And it was much, much more sad and much more, he didn't automatically get to fill up his bucket with all of this new information that's ever so interesting, like, because that's how my brain worked. For him, it wasn't like that. And so that was really hard for me to watch. And I mean, I was more than happy to support him through that. But that kept it more real for me, that this wasn't like, ooh, a fun new game, and now I know all these other new things. And watching what it meant to him was really, really hard. And it still is hard. It's still, that's hard. So, yeah.
So you seem to get some relief from, well, not some, but you got a great deal of relief from separating yourself from everyday church stuff. Is there anything else that you found healing or you found to, you know, fill your spiritual cup again since that gospel doctrine manual is not going to do it anymore? What was that that helped you in that way?
Many active, faithful Mormon would find it very hard to believe or accept that I feel so much more in tune with God and spiritually led than I had before. And it's because before, all communication between me and God had to be filtered through what I knew to be true, which was the church and what the church teaches. And that was the kink in the line. That's why I think it wasn't working for me my whole life, is because I was asking preset questions, hoping for preset answers, because that's what I've been taught, you know. Whereas now the communication is wide open, and I went from being homophobic 3 years ago and believing Bruce R. McConkie's line of thought regarding black people and Packer's teachings on homosexuals to all of a sudden, I mean, gosh, it's like now I understand what true Christ-like love is. And it's none of those past things. I was always an outlier in Mormonism. Like, my friends all did drugs or smoked and stuff. I didn't judge people for stuff like that. I never cared about what people wore or tattoos or anything like that. I never cared about that. So I thought I was very open-minded and empathetic before, but actually leaving the church and letting go of this is the one true church, what they say, you know, is what God thinks or feels, then all of a sudden I just have such empathy for people and such love and such a lack of judgment, that before I might see a transvestite and be like, that poor person's so confused. If only they knew what God's real plan is for them. And now I see a transvestite and I'm like, oh my gosh, what can I learn from them? I want to know their story. I want to learn. No longer am I the one that's right, you know. I'm the one that's willing to learn or love. Period. It's just love. And that's something I never thoroughly could do before, even though I felt like I was. So, and I've read The Prophet by, is it God, Galileo Kilbrain? It's. I'm sorry, I totally botched his name. But it's an amazing book, amazing. And that was very spiritual for me to read. I loved that. And I'm an English major. I've always been able to, one of the reasons I didn't like the Book of Mormon is, honestly, for me, there have always been better books out there. And so I've been able to tap back into, things don't have to be verifiably true to be uplifting and spiritual and help you communicate with God or humanity. But yeah, my view of God has definitely changed. It's undefinable. I don't know that it's, you know, if he's just like us, if it's a chick, if it's, you know, I can't define any of that anymore. All I know is that whoever it is I'm communicating with on whichever level we're communing, I feel really good about. I feel really, really good about. And I no longer need to define that. And the scriptures I will always love. I spent way too much time with them to not love them, but I no longer see anything as, you know, deity inspired or stamp of approval, God's hand wrote this. No, I don't. Any of them.
Do you see the scriptures along the same level as like Henry David Thoreau and some of these other literary works?
I can, but it has to be passages, because the scriptures,
yeah, not as a whole,
are full of some of the worst stories around. So that's something that changed. Was even the story of Abraham. People are like, oh, well, polygamy, you know, he's bringing back, it's Abraham did it. I'm like, yeah, that's a horrible story. The story of Abraham. That is like one of the worst stories around. when you just look at it from a moral, or even like, who is this God that sets this up? You know, sorry, I can't have a baby. Sucks to be you. So then you get Hagar. Then she has a baby. And it's like, oh, no, I am going to make Sarah pregnant. And now we're going to have wars for thousands of years afterwards about this birthright.
Yeah.
And killing your child because God tells you to, I think is horrible. You know, all of it. I think that those stories, I can now see them for exactly what they are. And as a literate person who does comparative literature in college and stuff, I compare them to David Thoreau, and I will read Thoreau or Walt Whitman or A.A. Milne or like The Little Prince. Those are books that fill my soul. And for me, I like the Bible and the Mormon canon about as much now as I like Tolkien's canon. You know, it's something to work in, and it's something I love to study, but I don't know. There are passages that are beautiful, so beautiful, that, you know, are transcendent. And there are stories that you can learn from, but as books as a whole, it's not anything I'd ever promote or hold up as something that I'm like, yeah, this is God's story, you know. This is, yeah, I don't see it as that.
So if you had a friend or a family member or someone saying they want to learn, what would you suggest to them to start with?
Well, for me, I would suggest where I started was Rough Stone Rolling. It's so important as a Mormon to start with a trusted source, because you know, knowing that it was produced by and sold by Deseret was huge for me. We're just taught and fearful of anti-Mormon literature, you know. The biggest breaking point for me was realizing that so many things that I had refuted in the past as lies and anti-Mormon literature, oh my gosh, all of those were true. They were actual factual things that happened in our past that the church just didn't teach us about. And so most people, to come across any of those tidbits, would reject it as, well, that's not true. That didn't happen. They would have told me had that happened, you know. Whereas if you're reading it from somebody that is a stake patriarch and the church allowed, you know, they published this book, and it's generous. There's room for the divine there. There are tons of people who have read Rough Stone Rolling. It shifted their worldview, you know, but they remain faithful members of the church. I absolutely think that's where everyone should start. Because it starts at the beginning, and that's the most important part. I think that Rough Stone Rolling, and then I'm a huge fan of The Letter to the CES by Jeremy Reynolds, who I'm chummy with. We're good buddies now. I came across that. I'd already been out of the loop for nearly 9 months or something, and that was very, very it was cool to come across, because it was all of my problems very eloquently laid out in one spot. So Rough Stone Rolling to begin with, and then if you want the bigger breadth of the issues, then The Letter to the CES.
So let's say they really, because of their family ties, they're, you know, they live in Utah where they're it's a little bit harder to leave.
Sure.
I would think. Let's say they don't want to go down, like they want to know the stuff, but they really want to stay. They want to make it work. So I would not think you would recommend the CES letter if that was their goal after Rough Stone Rolling.
No. My problem at this point in time with Mormonism, though, is the informed consent. That's my biggest problem. I love Mormonism. I love people who are Mormons. I want to see it succeed, but it just eats me up inside that I felt very informed. You know, I was very studious. I was a very good Mormon, but I was not actually truly informed about the decisions I was making. And so that's kind of it, is I think that all Mormons should read the CES letter. They need to know and choose to go forward in faith. Or even if it's not the CES letter, but all of those things need to be informing their faith. It has to be an informed decision for it to be a true testimony, period, in my opinion. because Corbin Volus wrote an excellent post on this last month, that it's Satan's plan to not have any choice, to only be shown the good, to only, you know, to only be shown the faith promoting stuff. How is that even a testimony if you don't even know what you're up against? If you don't even know the real restoration narrative, if you don't even really know who Joseph Smith or Brigham Young or our current prophets are, I mean, there's still the Hoffman, that was what, like 15, 20 years ago? I mean, it's still happening. So that's it. And there are plenty of Mormons who know all of that and are very faithful Mormons. And I think that's the type of Mormon all Mormons should be. Because otherwise it sucks and you don't want to leave, but I just don't know how much it's worth. I suppose, if it's not an informed decision.
Right.
That's not saying they're all stupid or naive. I'm just, I don't want to get that across, but yeah. So someone who can't leave, then, you know, that it would ruin their marriage and ruin their life or get kicked out of BYU. Don't leave while you're at BYU. You keep that in your hat. Yeah, you've got to choose a point in your life where it's going to be healthy. I realized much more now. At first, I was much more about my truth bombs and letting everyone know, you know, they have to know. And like I just said, the informed and stuff. But at the end of the day, your family is the most important thing that will ever happen to you in this life, and your relationships and your ties to those people. And that's the most important thing. So maybe, you know, bring your puke bag to church for those lessons that are harder, that aren't taught accurately. if there's that heavy dichotomy there, like there was for me. But other than that, I mean, I think that we can all make it work. You just have to keep your priorities and see the good in things. There's tons of good there. There's tons of good there that you can make work, you know? And so, but at some point in time, I think most of the people who have the curiosity bug, like me, it was a matter of time. It was just a matter of time. And for me, God told me to read the book. You know, I felt very spiritually led, so much more so than any other point in my life. You know, so for me, it's a conversion story. It's just as beautiful and happy and spiritually inspired as any one of the ones that brought people into Mormonism. For me. If anyone wants to tell me I was beguiled or, you know, ill-informed or whatever, then I know that that's not the case. So, but yeah, you got to put your family first. You got to put your family first. You have to be true to yourself, but you can be true to yourself and still respect your family and still make room for them and their beliefs and what matters to them and their faith and their love and all of that. I think everyone needs to go down their own road, but don't let it tear anything else apart because it's totally not worth it. Totally not worth it. Being right about Mormonism being false is completely not worth losing anything else over, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you need to be judicious in how you – I agree. Your relationships are the most important thing, and sometimes when you're feeling all fired up about – I don't know, something like Thomas B. Marsh or who knows. I mean, you could pick any number of things that you might be upset about. You could do some damage if you're not able to think of the relationship first.
Yeah. I the one I will always go to bat for and I think is so important is LGBT equality and inclusion on all levels. That's the one that I personally do think is worth ruffling feathers in our own families and stuff. Cause so many people won't ever even, if you're only surrounded by your echo chamber, which would be at church and stuff. I don't know. I think it's up to all of us to be that voice. And that's the only one that I would really go to bat for. I mean, Thomas B. Marsh, suck it. I don't care. That doesn't, I said S, sorry. That wasn't the F word. But, but that I'll totally drop. I'm so over that. You know, that is not what I will go to the mats for, but loving and full inclusion of LGBT individuals, is that's the one that will prevent suicides. That's what's going to change the world for a better place. And that's what I think is going to be Mormonism. Even, I mean, women, egalitarian, equality for women is really important. But that no one's committing suicide over that. That's not ruining lives nearly as badly as, I mean, I, for me, there are priorities. So that's the one I think. If you feel inclined to be open and honest and supportive about anything about, you know, that might run against the grain of Mormonism, then that's the one I feel just so passionately about. And that's my blog posts related to that and my actions there, the things I'm most proud of. So. Mm-hmm.
It's been a good conversation. It's a compelling story, I think. And thanks for sharing it with us.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, have a good Sunday afternoon.
You
day.
Too. Well,
okay.
See you around. Bye.
Yep. Take it easy. Bye.
My final interview in this episode is with Jeremy Timothy. Jeremy has been blogging at Rational Faith since the summer of 2013. The topics he typically covers include science, faith, and disability within Mormonism. You might notice there's a little bit of a rough editing going on where we inserted a section about science, specifically evolution and faith in Mormonism. This we had to record later because we forgot to discuss it in our main conversation. I think you'll still enjoy it.
Well, I grew up in the Mormon stronghold of Sugar City, Idaho, 5 minutes out of Rexburg. My father worked at Ricks College, now BYU, Idaho. I got out of there, avoided BYU, Idaho, and ended up at Utah State, where I met my lovely wife. And then went to medical school in the Midwest, and now we've moved back west, but further south, because my wife hates winter, and we're in Arizona, Gilbert, Arizona.
So, like many in, I think, all the Rational Faith bloggers, there's been some sort of awakening or transition that has occurred. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that story? What was it that made you think a little bit different?
Well, you know, I'd have to say it's kind of been a lifelong thing. In that, well, and everyone uses the shelf metaphor. There's always been this thing on the shelf. But they were kind of things that I would think about and ponder from a young age. There was, I think I read Mormon Doctrine when I was 16, which is a little unusual. It bothered me a lot. And I had to work myself through the issues that it presented, particularly the anti-Catholicism, but also some of the justifications it gave for the priesthood thing, which I think was always a huge question for me. I never understood it. And on my mission, it became a bigger issue because I had to go to African Americans and try to explain it or defend it, and the answers always seemed so weak. But I also had some really powerful faith-building experiences in my life, too, that made me very close to the church. And I consider myself a in the 2000s, when Mormon Stories came off the ground, that I was interested in podcasts and started following that. And it was the podcast with Margaret Blair Young and Bryce Gray, where they talked about the origins of the priesthood band, that it was the first time ever in my life that it made sense. That there was this folklore out there that blacks were cursed, and that's why they were slaves, and it was a natural rationalization to explain why slavery, because as a Christian, slavery just doesn't seem like something they should be doing, and to see how Mormons adapted that, and to learn the history behind it was fascinating. It made so much sense, and it was so great to have an answer But what that also meant, and what was the big shift for me, was that the prophets can really get it wrong on matters of policy, and that not only did the ban really have instituted, but it took very, very long time, longer than it should have, because of holding the tradition and the assumption that God was behind it to get rid of it. And that, I think, was really what set off what you would call a faith transition in myself. And it simmered and it brewed over several years, pretty much up until a couple of years ago. And during all this time, I was getting into history, learning all the historical questions and issues that people have problems with. And most of them I could work my way through, but that one, I think, was my big issue. I read Rough Stone Rolling because I wanted to know all the issues in history. And then I read On the Road with Joseph Smith, which is Richard Bushman's sort of a memoir that he wrote while he was touring and promoting Rough Stone Rolling. Because and that was fascinating, to get into the head of what Richard Bushman was doing and trying to accomplish with that book, and what his point of views were in the gospel. I love that book. I mean, this all happened, I think, starting in med residency. And once I finished residency, I landed here in Arizona, and I was back in the stronghold, I think, of Mormonism. And I just felt like a stranger. And it became harder and harder and harder to go to church. It became harder to sit through Sunday school because it just didn't fit the things I knew anymore. And it was the same things I'd been hearing all my life, and it was so repetitive that church became more and more and more difficult to go to. So I think that's kind of where things came to a head this maybe a couple of years ago.
Okay, so you kind of had two hits. You had the... It's interesting, you read Mormon doctrine, which is supposed to teach you more about the beauty of God, and it causes more trouble than it does good. So you had the blacks in the priesthood issue that you had to deal with on your mission, and you kind of learned how to deal with that, and you learned more about church history from Rough Stone Rolling and some other things, and especially learned about what Richard Bushman was all about. And then you feel semi-comfortable, it sounds like, and it starts all over again just trying to live with that knowledge. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's about right.
All right, so from there, is that where you are right now, or have you been able to get more comfortable with living in paradox?
Well, you know, I was pretty despondent, I think, at that point. And something that happened that really brought me back pretty much a year ago was discovering the Thoughtful Faith podcast. In particular, the interview they did right when The God Who Weeps came out. Because Terrell Givens, he had a hold at least on the things that really have always resonated strongest in Mormonism for me. And so where I'm getting this experience at church that just seems intellectually stifling, and I see the faults with it and the problems with it, I think eloquently explained the things that really I value most in Mormonism, and he kind of, you know, I don't think it's exaggeration to say, I think he saved the church from it. So that was a big help.
So when I think of the Givens, I don't think so much about history and stuff, maybe a little bit about culture, but I think about theology and the way that they interpret church history from a theological perspective and the way prophets are what we should or should not expect of prophets. And they have a very good way of describing a positive vision of God and a compassionate, loving God. So the theology, if I'm understanding this right, the theology is something that you find compelling, you find inspiring, and gives you enough emotional and spiritual strength to continue onward. Is that about right? Would you want to add something to how I'm interpreting or understanding that?
No, I'd say that's exactly right. I just had to remember what made Mormonism valuable to me, and have it, and to hear it stated by them that eloquently. And it is, it's the eternal progression. It's the God who weeps. It's the tragedy of mortality and agency. And yet the gift of it, it's complex and it's beautiful. And I've always loved it, but I needed to hear it again.
When I was talking with Adam Miller, he made the point towards the end of our interview that every generation has to rebuild. And depending on what is important to that generation, there's different parts that need to be rebuilt. And I think the Givens are doing a great job in rebuilding or reframing or just bringing to light the really good things about Mormon theology, the good things that Joseph Smith was finding and being revealed through the Spirit. I often think that the church and being a member of the church is more complex than just you and the church. You have the relationship between you and the institutional church. And each generation, every couple 10 years, that sort of shifts a little bit in the behavior of the general authorities and the tone of their discourses. And then you have your relationship with you and your local church, and that can vary from area to area, and even within stakes, different wards can have very different personalities, and it can be positive or negative. And you can have your relationship with church history, which is complex and not all positive. And then you have your family bonds, and finally you have Mormon theology. That's definitely a part of it. And so it's not so simple to say, well, if you don't believe this one thing, or if you have a problem with this, why are you sticking around? There's a lot of reasons that people stick around, and some of it's family, some of it's part of it's beautiful.
Sure. In fact, I think half my problem was that we've had a difficult time clicking in our ward just because we are different. I mean, around the same time that I had such a hard time going, I don't know, there were issues. It was around the time of the election, and my wife, at least, was not very silent as to where we stood, and she lost a leadership position because of it, mostly because she would call people out on Facebook memes that you could snopes and were clearly false and didn't make people happy. So that was part of it, too. It was just that I just started thinking, you know, maybe the church isn't for me, even though there were parts I still really valued, and certainly my family I really value, and it would certainly stress them if I ever left. But yeah, I agree, it's all very meticulous. So anyway, you know, as part of going through this, all in college, I mean, in college you get your own kind of faith crisis just because you're stretching out, especially coming from Sugar City. You're introduced into a larger world than a lot of people are. But in science, the big thing, again, this is Mormon doctrine, this is the culture I came from, is that evolution has to be this big hoax. And it became quite apparent to me, I think, during biology classes that the evidence was pretty overwhelming that it wasn't a hoax. And so that actually moved me in order to reconcile that from to something of a less literal approach to the scriptures that actually I think has ultimately been helpful to me. But it moved me to really, but it also helped me realize that, you know, evolution isn't opposed to Mormonism. One of the things that's great is the BYU, statement on evolution by the biology department that explains that, you know, this isn't incompatible. And yet, sadly, as a religion, we believe in evolution less than anyone except the Jehovah's Witnesses. And as a neuroscientist and a biologist, I find that really depressing. But I have found my faith actually growing through an understanding of the way evolution works, because it makes a lot of sense to me, you know, a creation through evolution is the way it works, and it fits with agency, and it fits more than anything with eternal progression. It's, for me, I've been able to weld that into one whole, and I think that's something that's also helped me overall to make it through kind of a brittle, literal approach to Mormonism to a more flexible and, I think, rich approach. Maybe that's a self-serving thing to say, but to one that can weather challenges.
Yeah, so the evolution fits, like you said, it fits really nice with a lot of the principles of Mormonism, but it challenges the age of the earth, and we've got a couple scriptures. It challenges the scripture in 2 Nephi where there's no death before the fall. It challenges this rigid version of how things are, how things came to be, and really it's in some ways I can see how people are afraid of it, because if the fall is challenged by the scripture in 2 Nephi combined with evolution, then that ties right into the atonement. That ties right into these ideas that are very close to the heart. So how do you go about, how do you transition, do you think, from the real rigid, literal version to something where you're looking more at principles? Like, how do you read the creation accounts and either not be irritated by them and not shut off your brain with regard to evolution and geology and astronomy and all these other things that challenge those accounts?
Well, the way I've come to view things over time is to look at how big the concept of God is and how limited we are as mankind, as these creatures, and actually learning about the brain. I've learned a lot about how the brain's not perfect. We have tools. Science has been a wonderful tool. Our communication has enabled us to stand on the shoulders of giants in history and to advance forward. But there's our understanding so limited. And I've come to see God is someone who has so much truth to give us, but we have this culture that we grow up in, and that our understanding is boxed and framed by, and that's what God has to work with. And I think God cares about everyone, and they all have this cultural framework. And I think in order to get people to work back to him, he pours out revolution that works within that framework, and that will draw the air to him. And so we can see these truths in all religions that are deep and that are powerful and rich. But are also fitted to their understanding, and so they necessarily have parts of mankind in them. Now, as far as the atonement, that's had to be an experiential thing for me. I've lived the atonement. I've had a powerful experience as a teenager where I think coming to know Christ spiritually saved me in a time of deep depression. And I go more into that, I think, a little in the podcast. But I fall back on that, which isn't, and yet, you know, I don't reject science at all. It's a huge part of what I do professionally. I think it's a wonderful tool. But I it's a mistake to reject the intuitive and the spiritual, because it's a powerful part of who we are as humans, and to deny it, I think, is to deny your humanity to some degree.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think we had that Jonathan Haidt podcast, and we talked about how we think that we're rational, but we're really not. And when we only settle for cold, hard facts, and I'm not saying everyone has to be religious, everyone has to do things this way, the way that I'm spiritual or the way that I'm passionate, but I think it's a mistake to just write stuff off because we don't have cold, hard facts supporting it. I mean, that's what art is. That's what so many things are in our life, are just our experience and our feelings and our passions flowing through us. It's a little silly and short-sighted to just shut that off.
Yeah. But it's too easy to do, I think, in our Western culture, which is different than any other culture, I think, in history. And I think we've kind of lost touch with some important parts of being human that you have to struggle a little more to regain.
Yeah, you might be right there, where you learn a little bit about Buddhism and other faiths, and maybe this is a plug to learn about other faiths, but you learn that they embrace suffering, that it's part of, you know, they, instead of trying to avoid it all the time, they're embracing it. There's a lot to be learned from other philosophies beyond rational thought. Rational thought's really important, but there's a lot more out there.
Yeah, there's more to truth than rational thought.
All right, well, if you had maybe a ward member or a family member or something, and they're starting to be more interested in Mormon studies, into learning more about Mormon history, maybe looking at the Bible more critically or the scriptures as a whole more critically, what are the books or resources in general that you think that you would recommend?
Well, I think Rough Stone Rolling is a good place to get a handle on the problems people have with the original church history. But I do strongly recommend On the Road with Joseph Smith too, because mostly Rough Stone Rolling is a presentation of the history, and it does present Joseph Smith warts and all. And I do like the approach it uses of trying to present it all the way Joseph saw it, for good or ill, and you can let the chips fall where they may. I think it's kind of sad that because he was a believer, the book got largely ignored, but that is what it is, at least by the academic community. But I think he also had a purpose for the general church membership to kind of introduce and ease them into those kind of issues, and I think it does that. I like The God Who Weeps, as I mentioned. I mean, those are the books that worked for me. I don't know about the books that work for everyone. For issues of the modern church, I think David O. McKay and The Rise of Modern Mormonism is a great book. But those are the ones I can think of offhand.
All right. Well, that's a great set of recommendations. I think those are the first two, The God Who Weeps and Rough Stone Rolling, are recommended quite a bit these days. But I just want to thank you for your time and sharing a little bit more of your story. And we'll definitely be linking to the A Thoughtful Faith interview, where you can hear a little bit more detail, well, a lot of bit more detail of Jeremy's journey. And hopefully all of you listening, if you find something that you can identify with one of the bloggers, hopefully it will help you along your way. So thanks, Jeremy.
No problem.
All right. Take it easy.
All right. Thank you. Reach out, touch faith.